Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. Today's episode is sponsored by ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. Visit their website at isaac1.org, I-A-S-I-C-1.org, to follow the science on marijuana. Friends, fentanyl is plaguing America. There is no safe drug supply unless it comes from a legal pharmacy. If you are around anyone who may be using drugs, you should carry naloxone, the opioid reversal agent. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show, submit a question, or download a free prescription for naloxone. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a Kratom conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. An estimated 1.7 million people have used Kratom in 2021. What is it? Kratom is a plant with many different chemicals, and it can cause addiction. People use or misuse Kratom despite the fact that the drug and its related compounds are not approved by the FDA for any medical use. People think plants are natural and healthy. While plants are indeed natural, there are many poisonous plants. Think about nicotine, opium, cocaine, oleander, death cap mushrooms. Whether something is healthy or not depends on indication, dose, contaminants, side effects, and risk-benefit profile. The active ingredient in Kratom is mitragine. Mitragine produces opiate effects like morphine or fentanyl. In addition, it can cause stimulant effects like methamphetamine. People want to know if Kratom is healthy or safe. Kratom, the plant, specifically is known to carry contaminants such as heavy metals and bacteria. In 2018, there was a large national salmonella outbreak in Kratom products. 199 cases, 41 states, 54 hospitalizations. The investigation concluded a global problem of minimally processed botanical substances intended for oral consumption. Side effects of Kratom can include neurological symptoms, heart and lung issues, and gastrointestinal problems. Side effects also include drug interactions, neonatal exposures, and drugged driving. There's also an unknown safety in long-term health. In 2019, a report found that 11 people died of Kratom. So why do people use it? Addiction is one answer. The path to addiction starts with feeling good by a drug and then not being able to stop. It's a great business model. People use Kratom to self-treat pain, anxiety, depression, opioid withdrawal, and opioid cravings. You may wonder, isn't Kratom better than heroin or fentanyl? I hate to choose one illegal drug over another, or one bad drug over another. Both of them can kill you, but it is true that the dose of fentanyl, the potency, is much more than for Kratom. However, there's no need to choose between fentanyl or Kratom to treat opiate use disorder. We have FDA-approved medications with known dosing and no risk of heavy metal or salmonella poisoning. Namely, the treatment would use buprenorphine. On the show notes, I will include the link from NIDA on Kratom. They have a great section with FAQs. As a doctor, I am sad to see a lot of self-prescribing in our society without consulting a doctor or pharmacist or the science or following the standard medical risk-benefit assessment. This applies to Kratom, marijuana, and psychedelics. And with that, let's hear our question of the day.
Hello, Dr. Lev.
Thank you for all the work you do on addiction.
I enjoy working with you in the emergency department.
I know someone who uses Kratom. I know the person suffers from addiction. My question is whether Kratom, it helps with addiction, is it helpful or harmful? Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. I love working with you in the emergency department. We have a very rough job. All of society's problems brought right in front of our doors, and we have to deal with it. It can be heartbreaking, violent, demanding, but also very rewarding. Thank you for being the angel of our emergency department. You compassionately care for people when they are at their worst. To discuss your question, I invited not a medical professional, but a lawyer. Shanik Darab is a partner at Arns Davis Law and leads the firm's complex litigation practice area. He litigates a wide range of class action matters, including personal injury and wrongful death. On April 7th, 2023, he was quoted in an article in the Los Angeles Times. The headline read, "He kicked alcohol, became addicted to wellness drink that works like opioid." We're going to be talking about that. And to learn more about Shanik Darab, check out the High Truth show notes. Shanik Darab, welcome to High Truth.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am very excited for this podcast, something different, a lawyer on the show with some interesting litigation. I want to talk about what Kratom is, about Mr. Torres, your plaintiff, this wellness drink, and your lawsuit. But first, let's talk about you. Tell us about yourself, what you do, how you got into this.
Sure. So I'm a plaintiff's litigator in California. I've been doing this for six years now. I'm a partner at Arns Davis Law Firm, and we do mainly cases representing people. So about half our practice is representing folks in the trades, workers, construction workers on job sites, and personal injury and those types of actions. The other half is representing folks who have been harmed or their rights have been infringed in some way. And those are in what's called complex litigation. And that's the sort of department that I lead, the practice area that I lead. So these are cases that have to do with consumers who may have suffered because of a product that they purchased, whether through products liability or consumer fraud, workers who may have been denied wages, victims and survivors of sexual harassment or abuse, institutional abuse, really anything, you know, any situation where an individual, a large group of individuals has been harmed in some way. We file suits representing those folks against individual private corporations or public entities, whoever is responsible.
Interesting. And you decided to become a lawyer because you like to argue?
People say that. Yeah, no, you know, it's funny. I was a terrible student in high school and in college. I just never really found my passion until I went to law school. I mean, it was sort of like I bounced from thing to thing, various passions and hobbies, and I was very focused on whatever those were. But academically, I didn't do very well. And then, you know, all of a sudden I got into law school because I happened to be a good test taker despite my grades. And in my first class, I had a constitutional law professor who sort of revealed to me what the law could do, what you could do as a lawyer and you know, create this access to justice. And having grown up as a child of immigrants from India, you know, I had no exposure to the American legal system before, except for what's on TV. I didn't really understand how fundamentally baked in it is into the fabric of society and what a great power and ability that is to be able to help people. So I'm a big comic book fan. You can see behind me, there's a little Superman on my bookshelf. So when I decided to become a lawyer and specifically a plaintiff's litigator, to me, that was sort of the closest I could get to being a superhero.
That's very good. And so you're doing that as a lawyer, but you're also doing, you're an activist.
Yeah, I'm a public servant. I am serving my second term on the school board in Palo Alto, where I live. Like I said, you know, education was such a big part of my story, and education not serving me in some ways and serving me in others. And so when I came back to Palo Alto after law school and I became a lawyer, I got very involved locally in schools, and I ended up running for school board, and I was elected the youngest, you know, school board member in the history of our district. And I just got reelected. The voters saw fit to bring me back in as we sort of led the district through the turmoil of COVID.
That's great. Congratulations. And all right, Superman. Let's talk about Kratom. Does that give you Superman powers? Tell us about, I gave our audience a little bit of a Kratom 101 lesson, but tell us from your perspective as a lawyer, what is it? What isn't it?
Sure. It's an unregulated substance. And that's sort of the first and foremost thing, because a lot of different substances are regulated. And so when you run into regulations, there are ways you can and can't pursue lawsuits against manufacture of those products if there is regulation. A lot of times regulation can preempt certain areas of lawsuits, right? If the FDA or USDA or other agencies in the federal government have made a determination about the health or about the classification of a substance, then sometimes lawsuits about the health or effects of a substance can be preempted. And so because it's unregulated, it's an area where you see manufacturers using it in all sorts of ways because there's no restriction on it. But it also, by the same token, provides individuals who've been harmed by it an opportunity to recover in the civil legal arena, where they might not be able to if there was regulation, because there'd be another avenue for recovery, right? There'd be agencies and there'd be a avenue through those agencies to recover. So, it's sort of a Wild West because nothing really restricts how kratom is used. There are no requirements about labeling with respect to disclosures which are specific to kratom. Of course, there are other laws. For example, in California and in many other states, there are labeling laws that require products that have side effects or have allergens to be labeled. If there is some scientific consensus that the manufacturer knew or should have known about with respect to the effect this could have on individuals, they have to label and disclose that. So there are lots of laws that keep people safe if they're followed, even if there isn't regulation. But kratom operates in this unregulated area, which makes it much more difficult to enforce those laws.
So kratom is a plant. It's not legal. And how do people buy it? Is it, powder, pill, teas?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not that it's not legal, but it's not legal and it's not illegal. It's the sort of gray area, right? People buy it in powdered form. People buy it in extracts. And, there are instances where, because the FDA has had a longstanding requirement or restrictions on its import, there are importers who import kratom in under the guise of not suitable for human consumption to get around those import restrictions. And so that's, it's a danger the FDA has warned about. Because when you start importing things in not safe for human consumption, you don't know what it's adulterated with and whatnot. So what we've seen is bulk kratom is what's used in this product. The powdered form is what we understand to be shipped to the manufacturer. We don't know what happens from there yet. We don't know how it's changed or altered, if it is, and how it's added to make the final product. But there was a recent seizure by U.S. Marshals of about 1,000 pounds of bulk kratom from the manufacturing facility for Feel Free, for the botanic tonics. And so you can see the FDA is starting to crack down on kratom because there have been so many reports over the last few years about how it's really
affecting. Where is it coming from?
Lives.
Is it from Asia?
Yeah, it's we've seen it Asia, it's Indonesia, Thailand. Those seem to be the main places.
Interesting. All right, so it's coming in. Obviously, it can't be legal if U.S. Marshals are seizing it, right?
Yeah, it was a very interesting seizure because up until now, what we've seen from all the filings is that the FDA, the federal government, has seized kratom because it's been adulterated or because they've alleged it's been adulterated. In this particular instance, that's not why they seized it. They seized it because In their complaint they filed in Oklahoma federal court, they said that the kratom itself constituted a product, an adulterated product that Botanic Tonics had not shown was essentially reasonably safe for use. So to me, it demonstrates sort of a policy shift that's happening where the FDA is starting to crack down on kratom in a way that it hasn't done in a while, because there is a lot of politics around kratom. And there has been. So this might be a shift that we're seeing.
Interesting. And that'll be interesting to talk about what that politics is. But I want to get to Sam's question. Sam is a nurse in our emergency department, does amazing, life-saving, compassionate work. And he has an acquaintance that is using kratom, and he asked, does it help addiction or is it more harmful? What are the views? And maybe that's the politics of it too.
And that's the politics that we've seen. So people, there are lots of different views on kratom. And some of those views that folks have are that kratom can help with people who are already suffering from addiction to opiates. It's a less dangerous form, and it can help with the symptoms and the withdrawal symptoms as you wean folks off of opiates. And that's most likely why it hasn't been scheduled. There was sort of a big political fight in Washington about scheduling it as a Schedule I drug a year or two ago, and it ended up not being scheduled. And that is one of the reasons why. But because of that, our lawsuit isn't really about the health dangers of kratom. The lawsuit is about the failure of the manufacturer to warn of the side effects, because there are so many views of it that as lawyers and as the individual plaintiffs who were harmed, it isn't necessarily that we know everything about kratom and we can make the sort of judgment call on whether kratom is in a vacuum safe or unsafe. But what our clients know is that they should have been warned that something like what happened to them could happen because of what was in the product.
Yeah. So kratom has opioid qualities. So, so does heroin and morphine. But that's why it's used for people who have an opioid use disorder. It's like a replacement therapy. But like you say, it's unregulated. It's an unregulated plant. People think, oh, it's a plant, it's healthy. But then you have all sorts of contaminants and poisons, other side effects, other chemicals in that plant. And I feel like if somebody has an opiate use disorder, there are prescription grade, highly regulated medications that can be used and are very readily available instead of experimenting on yourself with an unknown plant with many different chemicals. There's one chemical in the plant that helps with opioid, that's opiate, but it also has, you know, hundreds of other chemicals that we don't know what they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you see abuse of kratom. You see it all across the country. In California alone, rehabilitation centers that treat for opioids also treat for kratom. And they treat it in much the same way as they treat opioid addictions, because it is an opioid, according to the FDA. And the effects and the symptoms and the addiction are very, very similar.
Right. So if you're around someone who uses kratom, what would you advise? Again, you're not a doctor, you're a lawyer, sure. But from the lawyer who deals with the problems, what would you say?
You know, after speaking to our office, we've spoken to so many of individuals who have been affected, not just by Feel Free, but kratom generally. And the stories that we hear are always have a common thread of it's really important to have a social network, right, to resource, a social net to resource, because otherwise, with any addiction, you are sort of left in the wind alone and you start to spiral. So the folks who've successfully come out of their Feel Free addiction or their kratom addiction have done so because of a strong support net, because of access to rehabilitation centers, which requires resources. So, you know, this is really a problem that can be solved, but it requires a certain amount of resourcing, whether it's, you know, the human capital of it or the financial capital requires resources. And sometimes folks who are already deep within that addiction don't have that. So if I were personally, you know, if a friend of mine, for example, had a kratom addiction, I would treat it much the same way as I would if they had any other opioid addiction. And I would encourage them to get support. I would give them support and encourage them to get professional help.
Interesting. So actually, I was going to say, we'll use alternatives, use something that's, you know, FDA approved instead of kratom. But what you bring out is very interesting. You're meeting a lot of people who have a serious kratom use disorder.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
we've talked to, you know, maybe 120 people so far, maybe probably more, but, you know, and we've seen over 1,000 people online in forums and in comments. And the stories have that common thread of, and they're specific to this product. I started using this product. I didn't know, you know, it was marketed as this wellness drink, safe, sober, healthy. I said, great. I took a drink and it instantly hit me and I was addicted. And certainly people who have had addiction in the past, who struggle with addiction in the past, who've been sober, it's been instant for them. The folks we've talked to, it's sort of like one bottle and they're instantly hooked onto Feel Free. And then they're spending tens of thousands of dollars a month on these $10 bottles.
Wow. Okay. We're going to have to learn more about that. Romulus Torres, he's your client, right? What I read in, you know, the article that got me to you is that he was very proud of his sobriety from alcohol and became addicted to kratom from this drink. What can you tell us about Mr. Torres? What happened to him? And, you know, and is it okay sharing his information?
Yeah. And you know, a lot of this is already in the publicly filed complaint. So it's fine to share. You know, Romulo, he's extremely courageous in stepping up to be the face, one of the faces of this, because he really wants something to change. He doesn't want people to continue to go through what he has. And his story, which has been in the news, is, you know, he struggled with sobriety. And then he was sober for years. And then one day he
and his drug was alcohol, right? It wasn't opioids or prescriptions.
Right. And he was sober from alcohol. And so he started to get these messages on social media, advertisements on Instagram that started advertising the product to him. And there were advertised as a safe, sober, and healthy buzz, advertised as generally healthy and clean and wellness, all the sort of wellness buzzwords. And so one day, after months of getting these targeted advertisements every day, he went into a 7-Eleven store and he saw it right there by the check stand. And it was you know, there's an advertisement saying it's the official drink of the University of Texas Longhorns. It's the official drink of the Florida State University athletics. And, you know, oh, it can't be unhealthy if these sports teams are doing it too. So he took a drink and it was downhill from there. I mean, everything that he had worked so hard to overcome all came crashing back. And you hear that story and folks hear that story and they think, wow, that's terrible and tragic, but certainly it's an outlier because, you know, that can't be everybody. But we have talked to so many people and it becomes clearer and clearer that for the folks who have been affected by this product, it is an extremely common story. They have struggled and overcome sobriety, whether it's alcohol, opiates, or something else. They are marketed the product through social media, through targeted advertisements. They believe that it's safe, sober, and healthy. They believe the wellness marketing. They see the sports teams on it. They get the product and it one bottle and they are hooked and their life goes back to the way it was. Family relationships are affected. Jobs are affected. It's tragic. And one only has to go online and look at, you know, a subreddit with over 500 people in it called Quitting Feel Free and just read those stories. You know, folks don't have to take my word for it. But those stories are all publicly available online, one after another.
You know, there's a genetic component to addiction, right? So some people can, I've heard this before in kids with the prescription opioid epidemic, you know, you'd give, you know, kids who get their wisdom teeth pulled out, they'll get an Oxy, right? And, you know, hundreds of kids may get an Oxy and they're fine, but you know, a few of them will get that one pill and that was it. It's like, wow. And they're hooked after, you know, one exposure, they're like genetically susceptible. So how is Romulus now? How's he doing?
He's doing better. He's, you know, he's working through it. He's at the place now where he's comfortable bringing this lawsuit. So he's, you know, he's worked through his addiction, but there are good days and there are bad days, like there always are.
I was wondering if he needed like Suboxone to treat that addiction.
I don't know the specific off the top of my head, the specific drug, but he did go to treatment. He went to treatment. He went to a rehab center and they treated him with the same thing they used to treat other opioid.
Okay. So maybe addictions. He got that same treatment. That's what I would think was used to, you know, since one opioid and mm-hmm. another one, a much safer choice. That's interesting. So I'm glad he's doing well. Let's talk about this drink, Fill Free Wellness Tonic, sold by Botanic Tonics in Santa Monica, a beverage company. All right, what is this drink?
Well, it is a, you could call it, I guess, an energy shot or a wellness shot is what they call it. It's like 2 ounces.
I wouldn't call it wellness.
No, but they call it wellness. They call it a wellness shot. They market it as a wellness shot. And it's this 2 ounce bottle, the 2 ounce blue bottle. And it is purported to give folks a sense of focus and energy. And also it's relaxing and it's purported to be some sort of social lubricant. An alcohol alternative is how it's marketed. And it contains kratom, which we've talked about, and kava, which is another,
psychedelic
herb. Yeah. It's another, and it's used in various traditional ceremonies. I think in some Polynesian cultures and Asian as well. It's more of a relaxant than kratom is. And so those two used in combination, we understand is what gives the drink its particular effects.
Amazing that they can target it as a alcohol alternative for people who have a problem.
Yeah, this goes to the heart of, you know, this case, and it's like the heart of this case is a false advertising case. And the question is, you know, how can you say something is an alcohol alternative? How can you say something can give you a safe, sober, and healthy buzz? How can you promote something as being an official drink of these sports teams when you should know that it has the potential to have these extreme side effects and cause extreme addiction in members of the public? That's the question.
I really, and I went to their website. Their advertisements are still there. They haven't taken any of those claims down. They still have videos showing how, you know, wonderful and natural this is, without mentioning the harms.
Yeah, you know, and one thing that has been remarkable is many people we talked to were turned on to this product by the marketing, and then it sort of was reinforced by various influencers on TikTok or, you know, social media, podcasters, wellness or biohacking podcasters who held out this product as being, you know, great and excellent and great for health. And they felt very much betrayed. And so it's another question of, you know, if you're an influencer and you're touting a product, what's the due diligence that you should be required to have when you have such a following who is going to believe what you say about that product?
Yeah. You could have blood on your hands. What about, did you or Mr. Torres or any of your clients report the product to the FDA? I mean, the FDA is looking for this, and they have a website where you can, you know, take a picture of the product, report it, and they're asking the public to report such effects. I'm wondering if you guys did that.
You know, I'm not sure if any of our clients have, although it's certainly worth looking into. It's highly likely that folks out there who were affected have, because there are so many folks who were affected. But I don't know
how to do that. And so I would urge you, for each one of these stories, any people that you do to share that. They're saying, I can share it with you afterwards, but they have a website, and you put it in, you tell the product, say the adverse effects, and then they have a collective. And that's really, really important, because when a decision comes to, schedule it, not schedule it, you know, make recommendations, the FDA counts on this data as their research. So what you know and what people are telling you, they may not have that information there, and they count on that. So I think that'd be important to share.
That's great. That's a great thing to do. Yeah, we'll definitely share that.
So, you know, if I went on searched and I looked under kratom, then I saw, you know, multiple things pop up, but most of it was from addiction and recovery and treatments that clearly warn people, don't use it if you don't use it with alcohol, and don't use it if you have a substance use disorder. interesting that, you know, people just don't see that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question is, when you buy a product, how many times do you look at the label and then Google each of the elements, each of the ingredients? It's, you know, what is the level of responsibility that we should expect the manufacturer and the marketer to have versus what should we push onto the consumer? And certainly in a case like this, you know, I think it's, you know, we can't expect consumers who have been told one thing by marketing to then take it upon themselves to try and disprove that. You know, it's our position that it's incumbent on the manufacturers and the marketers to really make sure that what they're saying is the whole truth and is not misleading in any way to consumers. Because otherwise it would put such a high burden on every consumer to do, you know, it's this huge amount of due diligence to check every ingredient in every product.
Right. And this case or this, you know, I'm sure there's other companies like this one, really struck me, like, how could this be legal? We live in a society that counts on consumer protection, right? I mean, just go to any grocery store. Everything is full of labels. You know, I open up a can of beans, you know what, there's safety, there's warnings, there's, you know, call centers to ask questions about the foods or allergies. You know, we have, you know, you watch TV, there you get, there's going to be like, you're going to get a warning before you see any flashing lights so you don't get a seizures if you're susceptible. I mean, we label and we warn the public on so many things. And then poof, now we have this whole industry that makes it unsafe for us to consume food. Like, we don't know if these drinks and additives and things that are sold like this wellness drink or, you know, cannabis shots or psychedelics, there's all of a sudden all the regulations and warnings that we've had in our society to consume products, especially food, are tossed away. So I just don't understand how this is legal and how these companies are getting away with it.
And, you know, certainly the lawsuit's position is that it's not legal, hence the lawsuit. And of course, the court will decide whether or not it's legal or not, depending on the arguments in the case. But, you know, our position is it isn't legal. California has very strict laws on advertising and unfair business practices and products liability. And the position is of our clients is that what Botanic Tonics did was not legal, and they are liable. Now, the other question is, will the California legislature do something about this? You know, the Business and Professions Committee is the committee that is charged with false advertising laws. And so what's really interesting is to see whether they're going to take this up and look into the current false advertising laws and see whether or not that framework adequately protects consumers given the unregulated supplement industry.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because it doesn't seem that they care about that when it comes to cannabis products that are being sold. I mean, the consumers are not being told about drug interactions and psychosis and suicidal ideations or cardiovascular effects or things, you know, most people, even physicians, have this information hidden for them when it comes to cannabis. That seems to be like a protected class there. People want to follow the money, but maybe there'll be a different standard for kratom.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, there can be plenty of discussions about the utility of kratom in treating addiction. But like we said before, you know, regulation is important because it creates a minimum safety net for consumers. And then you don't need lawsuits like ours. And then consumers can have that minimum level of safety and clarity.
So let's talk about this lawsuit. Tell us, by the way, how much do these drinks cost?
The last time we checked, $10 for a bottle, the 2 ounce bottle, around $10.
Wow.
Once the folks we've talked to, once they've gotten addicted, they're buying them by the case. And that racks up.
Wow. Okay. So the lawsuit, how many plaintiffs do you have? How much money? Tell us about that.
Sure. So we've got the class action, and that's a nationwide unfair business practices and false advertising lawsuit. And that's specifically predicated on the question of whether the marketing campaign that Botanic Tonics engaged in was misleading, whether there were material omissions and false statements that persuaded people to buy the product. We then got a number of individual cases on behalf of individuals. Those individuals, by the way, are all part of this, what's called the putative class, the proposed class in the class action, which covers basically everybody in the country who bought Feel Free. And these individuals, who we have individual cases for, also suffered health issues, side effects, addiction, and then really serious side effects that have ranged from skin issues to organ damage as a result of drinking Feel Free. And they've racked up medical costs, and they have, you know, future rehabilitation costs, and it's affected their lives, their livelihoods, their families. So for those folks, they've chosen to bring individual cases in addition to being a part of this class action, because in the individual case, what they're seeking is compensation for their economic and non-economic damages, what they've, you know, what they've suffered in their lives. And so these are brought under a different theory of liability, not false advertising and you know, unfair business practices, because we already have this class action here. These individual cases are brought under what's called products liability and negligence causes of action or claims. So in California, for example, there's a law that essentially says, manufacturer, if the product that you're making and selling to people has this potential to create side effects or allergic reactions in a measurable segment of the population, and you should have known that based on general scientific knowledge about this product, then you have to warn consumers about it. And if you don't do that, then you're strictly liable for any of those things that may happen to consumers. So that's what those cases are alleging. They're saying, look, sure, you said kratom was in it, right? Kratom is listed as an ingredient on the bottle in a very, very small print. But there's no information about potential side effects, about reactions, about addiction. And those lawsuits are all saying you were legally required to warn us about that. And because you didn't, our lives have been just so significantly affected. And we've had to spend tens of thousands of dollars and serious past and future health issues. So those are the two types of cases that exist right now that we're bringing.
And what damages are you seeking?
For the individual cases, the damages are, like I said, economic and non-economic. So that means, you know, compensation for money that folks have spent on medical, spent on, you know, future rehabilitation costs and therapies and things like that. Non-economic, which is, you know, how do you put a dollar value to how something has disrupted your life, how it's affected your family, how it's affected your hard work of attaining sobriety being completely broken down. So putting a dollar value to that as well. And that's, you know, very, very person to person specific. And then the class action, which is the false advertising, what we're seeking is what's called restitution, which is folks spent money on this product. Folks spent money on a product that they believed was one way. What they received was a product that had lesser value because it was actually something that was detrimental to them. And so they should be refunded basically the entire price they paid or a portion of the price they paid for the product. And so that's what we're seeking in the class action. Now, on an individual basis, if someone bought, you know, bottles for months and months, that money was significant to them, but of course it may not be significant to the company. But as a class action, when you're talking about every person in the United States who purchased this product, that can be a very large number.
Would it close it down?
Well, we're certainly, you know, as plaintiffs litigators, we're never in the business of trying to put companies out of business. We always want to try and find a path to justice, and that doesn't mean we try and take companies down necessarily. But it is a big enough number that if there was a verdict in this case for full restitution for all of the bottles sold, that might certainly be too big of a pill for the company to swallow. It might be too much for the company to survive. But you know, there are a lot of pathways before we get to that point, right? There's always a potential for settlement in every case. There is there are other defendants in the case too. 7-Eleven, for example, is in the case, and there are other retailer defendants who are going to be in the case too, because you know, our position is retailers have a certain level of responsibility as well if they're selling a product and sort of repeating the manufacturer's representations.
Interesting. Did 7-Eleven take off the shelf these products now?
It did. 7-Eleven has taken it off. Amazon has taken it off. We've seen that.
Good. Well, then you've done some good already.
Yeah.
You know, there are parents who are suing some of the social media companies like TikTok and YouTube for being a source of selling illegal fentanyl that has killed their children. I'm wondering if these social media companies are used to promote these non-approved drugs are liable as well.
That's certainly an open question. There are some laws that do provide certain levels of protection for platforms that host essentially what's, you know, free speech. That's the defense, right? That they raise that these the platforms aren't liable because the individuals on the platforms are expressing their own opinions and the platforms are just providing a place for free speech. And there are certain federal laws that that support that. But the larger question is from an ethical and a moral standpoint. And of course, you know, the law is really just based on ethics and morals. And of course, everyone has sort of differing ethics and morals. And so we have laws that are compromises. But from a fundamental ethical and moral perspective, should social media websites be liable for perpetuating the influencers who are marketing something if those things are falsely being marketed? And from a moral and ethical standpoint, I think most people would agree that yes, there is a level of responsibility there if you're perpetuating something that turns out to be false. From a legal standpoint, I think liability is more difficult. And so we haven't yet joined any social media platforms onto our lawsuit. I'm not sure if we will. Of course, we're still, you know, we've a great deal of research and figuring out whether that's viable or not before we do something. But, you know, from a personal ethical moral standpoint, there is certainly responsibility there.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'd like to see is, you know, at the end of this, admitting their guilt and to send a message to other companies not to engage in such behavior in the future, that they, you know, consumers need to have this stuff disclosed.
Yeah. And, you know, the class action, we talked about money, but the money isn't really the point of the class action, right? It's certainly something that folks are entitled to if they win. But from our client's perspective, change is the real motivator. So the what's called injunctive relief or non-monetary relief, making sure that there are certain disclosures, that's really the driving force behind this class action. Can we make it so that what happened to the tobacco industry, what happened to the e-cigarette industry, is something that can happen in the kratom industry as well? Because there are kratom products out there that already have disclosures. There are companies who sell kratom products who are being responsible and disclosing that kratom can have these side effects and can cause addiction and shouldn't be taken by pregnant individuals, and all the disclosures that folks in these cases would have expected to see on Feel Free. And so one of the things we're seeking is these types of disclosures going forward on Feel Free.
I wonder if you saw the recent announcement by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer calling on the FDA to investigate high caffeine prime energy drinks. Made me think of you, that these energy drinks are being sold to kids and it's not safe, but it's marketed to kids. One is, I thought the analogy to your kratom lawsuit, but also it was a little ironic because he's also the one pushing to legalize marijuana without the consumer protection to kids.
Yeah, you know, the politics behind regulation of all these substances is so complex and it's so steeped in history, right? in this country's history, going back to Prohibition. So it's one thing to have these political views about whether or not certain substances should be legalized or not, but coming right down to it from a boots on the ground perspective, as someone who represents folks who've been affected, it's really important to have full disclosure. That's the most important thing, right? People, you know, Americans value choice. And yes, that choice is predicated on being an informed choice. And so it's fine if folks want kratom to be legal and folks want, kratom to be accessible. And as long as they are provided with sufficient information to make an informed choice. And where we get into significant issues from a legal perspective is where there isn't that informed choice, where that information is either being withheld or misrepresented. And so that's exactly what, of course, as you know, is what's being alleged in these lawsuits.
Interesting. Do you see future lawsuits for the same reasons, for false medical claims, targeting children, marketing issues to cannabis products or the psychedelic products or other products that you see that are causing harm?
I certainly think that's a possibility. I know that the cannabis industry in California has sort of California, Colorado, they're sort of a head start on regulation than other states because it's been legal in some form in California for so long that there is some level of regulation, even if it may not be the same level as other substances. And so what that does, it provides a framework for lawyers. And so when folks are affected by, by something, then there's a framework for seeking redress. But, regardless of what the substance is, I certainly think there's always a possibility of lawsuits if, again, their product has been adulterated or changed in some way and the effects have not been adequately disclosed to members of the public. Cannabis is, by and large, understood in California. The general understanding is that cannabis it's a good thing that cannabis is legal and that cannabis is not as harmful as other substances. And yet, with any substance, when you adulterate it and you begin to change its formulation to make it more potent, there is the possibility that all of a sudden you're creating something that can have effects that sort of outstrip what has been disclosed to the public.
Yeah. So, I mean, as an emergency physician, I treat cannabis poisonings every single shift multiple times. Cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, cannabis induced psychosis, cannabis associated suicidal ideation, heart issues, drug interactions like every day. And up the street from me at Children's Hospital, two patients a day from marijuana poisonings. Number one is the gummies and they get it from their moms. So I imagine all those, I mean, I'm surprised that we allow these babies, really babies, average age of 2-3 years old, to be poisoned without any legal consequences. I thought maybe it's because parents are ashamed because the number one place that people get the gummies are from the parents. But there have been a lot of schools, right? Several times that we've seen headlines of people going to school, kids going to school, and then all of a sudden 911 is called and a bunch of kids are going to the hospital because of these gummies or bringing these, psychoactive drugs to school.
Yes. And, we see this like, even alcohol, right? You have alcohol.
But alcohol is really, first of all, two things that are different with alcohol. Actually, there's many differences with alcohol. But number one, people understand the risks. No, everybody understands the risks of alcohol. But the risks of cannabis are being hidden from the public, right? There's thousands of research that's you're just hearing, like you said, it's healthy, it's better than alcohol. That's one thing that's different. And the other thing is, when you're going to, if you buy alcohol, if you buy a beer or whiskey or wine, you're not going to find lead or arsenic. The FDA regulates that, right? So it's relatively safe in that sense. But if you're buying cannabis or psychedelics, There's no government regulations to tell you. It's more like buying that, you know, wellness drink. You don't know what's in it or what's contaminated in it. There's no oversight of that. But for alcohol, there is.
Right. Yeah. And I think this goes back to the sort of prohibition, you know, framework, which is like, well, perhaps if the federal government were to legalize cannabis in some fashion, then they'd be able to actually impose, you know, stringent regulations on it, as opposed to sort of having a patchwork of state-based regulations, which can't, I think, be as effective as what the federal government could do with the sort of weight of its regulatory powers.
I wish that was true. But like you said, California has had this legal for a long time. They have the cannabis of, you know, Bureau control that oversees it. And they've failed in their job to protect consumers. They have not done that. You don't know what you're buying.
Yeah. Well, I'm certainly no expert in cannabis and cannabis law, but I do have a great deal of knowledge on the issues of, you know, false advertising and false advertising law. And, you know, whether it's cannabis or any other substance, you know, if there was a cannabis product that, just like Feel Free, was being marketed as, you know, a safe, sober alternative, and it in fact turned out to have some highly potent extract of cannabis in it that resulted in effects from the people who took it, then I certainly think you'd have the same kind of case there as well. You know, certainly opiates are, at least in my mind, a level more than cannabis. But if there was some extremely potent adulterated extract of cannabis and nobody knew about it and didn't know that's what it contained, you'd have a similar type of case that we'd see with respect to false advertising and even maybe products liability cases. So from a false advertising consumer protection point of view, it doesn't really matter what the product is. It really matters what the effects are and what the, you know, what the marketing was. Because even supplements that are legal, if those supplements cause side effects, again, you could have a similar kind of case if there were no disclosures or warnings.
What about protection for children? So I recently saw a commercial for the Tide Pots, like the detergents, you know, things that, you know, do your laundry. And they did a whole big thing about, oh, we have safety packaging for children. And I could just imagine that some kid probably ate one of those packages, you know, went to the hospital, and now Tide is, you know, making these warnings. Why don't we have that for these cannabis products when we have so many kids? That's what I was thinking. Like, we have, you know, two kids a day just in one city getting sick off these products. And I was wondering, yeah, if there, you know, why aren't we seeing that?
It makes sense to me to have warnings for kids. I mean, as the father of a 3.5-year-old and an 8-month-old, you know, we were on vacation recently, and the Airbnb we were staying in had Tide Pods, and my 3.5-year-old sort of got one off the top of the washer, and I was doing something else in the same room, and then she asked me if it was candy. I was like, oh no, definitely not. And, you know, we moved it away in a cabinet. But again, like, there's so much of a potential for kids to get their hands on things that are colorful, that look vaguely the shape and size of candies. And it just, you know, in from a school board perspective, right, we've seen that with Juul. And we saw the way that Juul was marketed to slightly older kids. And we saw the lawsuits that were brought against Juul. And in fact, it was very much a similar set of lawsuits as our lawsuits against Botanic Tonics. The Juul lawsuits were a class action for essentially false advertising and unfair business practices, and then a series of individual cases for specific, you know, personal injury and health effects that it had on individuals. And those two moved together in the same way that ours are moving together. But with Juul, you saw a great deal of interest on the national level about regulating, about warnings, about marketing towards children. And any product that has the potential to be misused by kids is one that should have robust warnings and protections, in my opinion.
Yep. And we see that, I think it's really missing in cannabis and soon to be the psychedelics as well. I think it's just a matter of time before we see big lawsuits, just like we saw for tobacco. I mean, we're reliving history, right? Tobacco also made health claims, you know, denied any of the health hazards. You know, they made nicotine more potent. You know, they wanted the young consumer to have, like, you know, addiction for life, and they were doing well until the lawsuits. You know, until the lawsuits came. The same thing with opioids. Everybody should be on opioid. Nobody should suffer any pain. And then you know, denying any of the harms or blaming the patients. Well, you became addicted because you're an addict, not because of the opioids. And then the lawsuits, I think it's just a matter of time. I think even the industry knows probably it's just a matter of time before the same kind of lawsuits happens there.
Right. Well, once an industry gets large enough or bona fide enough, the financial incentives for bad actors to engage in, you know, some sort of manipulation exist. And so we saw it in tobacco. You see it, you know, you see it throughout. So yeah, it's scary. And certainly warnings and regulation can dispel some of that and create a safety net.
Right. Yeah. And what made it your case again is the fact that you cannot trust what you buy in food and drink anymore. You know, that's coming from these other stores. I mean, maybe if you buy it from the grocery store, you would hope that you have that type of consumer protection, but now we're seeing that it's not, which is why I think you say that the 7-Elevens and those stores are culpable.
Well, one of the stores that, you know, health stores, well-respected health stores were selling feel free. Many people know about Erewhon, which is a sort of well-reputed health, high-end health store in Southern California. And we've got a number of clients who bought it from there. And there were representations that Erewhon had made, you know, about its product, saying, if it's here, it's good for you. And so in addition to whatever the product and manufacturer said, you've got these retailers who are saying, we're adding to that, and people are buying into it and believing that it's safe.
Wow. Well, I wish you a lot of success in that. What is your words of wisdom to our audience as far as consumer protection, and what should people be aware of? Beware. How do you keep yourself safe?
Well, I would say take every bit of marketing with a grain of salt. And, you know, as much as the consumer shouldn't have to bear the burden of researching what's in a product, you should do it anyway, because there are many instances where you don't want to leave your health and your livelihood in the hands of marketers and advertisements.
Wow. That's profound. I think that's great. It's your life. They have a different motive than you do. I want to say thank you to Sam for your question, saving lives, stamping out disease in the emergency department. I bless you with personal health for your dedication and your life to helping others. And thank you so much, Shanik Darab. I hope you win and win big, not for the money, but for the lives that you'll be saving, and for sending a message that companies cannot gamble with other people's lives for profit. And really, how dare they knowingly poison and addict people? I think that's unconscionable. So I wish you success. And thank you so much for making the time and talking to me today.
Thank you, Dr. Lev. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answer your questions. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Isaac, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors educating on the harms of marijuana. Visit isaic1.org, that's ISIC1.org, to view their library that translates medical journals for public understanding, listen to their speaker series, and follow the science on marijuana. High Truth producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Oneet Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.